In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Every good story has one thing in common: overcoming obstacles. Back in my book editing days, my boss summed it up this way. The essence of plot is what does a character want and why can't they have it? Joe goes to the store, buys a can of beans, and drives home. That's not a story. Joe's family is starving, and even though he doesn't have any money, he sets out for the store believing, hoping that somehow God will provide. On the way, he stops to help someone, but they carjack him and take off with his own car. Standing on the side of the road, worse off than before, he could give up and go back, but he doesn't, and he walks the rest of the way to the store. Once there, he wanders to the back and picks up a can of beans, thinking maybe he should steal it and he could pay it back when he has some money. About to slip it into his pocket, he hears shouting up front. It's the carjacker holding up the store. While the thief is focused on the owner fishing dollars out of the till, Joe sneaks up behind and conks him on the head with the can of beans. In gratitude, the store owner gives Joe a bag full of groceries and a job. He'll start on Monday. In storytelling, you have to overcome adversity. That's the point of storytelling. How did someone manage to get past tremendous difficulties and not only survive, but be better because of those struggles? And it's the same in life. To grow as a person, to become whom you are meant to be, you must overcome adversity. That's why so many spoiled rich kids grow up to be such rotten people. That's why the whole woke movement is so miserable. It masquerades as helping other people, but it's really about making woke people feel good. Oh, look at the people I helped. I took away barriers they'd have to overcome. I made life easier. I took away the pain society inflicts on them. Taking someone's pain isn't helping. It robs them of their unique story. It robs them of the chance for them to learn to overcome what's in their way. It robs them of the chance to learn, to grow, to make their own way in life so that they can face their own problems and weaknesses and be better for it. Of course, there are times when people sincerely do need help, when they really can't get out of something on their own, but to presume they need you or government means that at its heart, you see them as inferior and incapable. Is that the message we want to send to people, especially children, that they're incapable? On today's show, we're pushing back on woke in our education system by providing opportunities and in the corporate world, which has lurched to the woke side. I'd like to welcome Donna Kreuzberg back to the show. She is a former CPA, business and tax attorney, and real estate broker. But rather than just sit back and enjoy retirement, she is leading the effort to improve Oregon schools by putting real school choice on the November 2024 ballot. Donna, it is great to talk to you again.
Well, thanks, Mark. It's good to be back.
Yeah. So for those who haven't heard or need a refresher, remind our audience what you're fighting for and why it's two initiatives rather than just one.
Okay. Well, what we're doing is school choice. And school choice is basically just allowing parents to have a say in where their kids get their education. We have basically four spots: public school, charter school, private school, homeschool. School choice just enables parents to decide which of those four spots meet the needs of their children. We began in June of 2021 with one combined measure that had open enrollment and a school choice. We ran it through the state process, and the state process kicked it out for some sort of arcane reason. Then in January of 2022, we pulled the one measure apart and made a standalone open enrollment and a standalone school choice. So now we've run those through the state process and everything is fine. We have approval from the Secretary of State, the Attorney General, and the Oregon Supreme Court. We have one measure, open enrollment, that allows parents to choose for their children any public school or charter school that has available space, regardless of where the parents live. So open enrollment meaning doesn't matter where you live, you can still go to any public school or charter school if that school has room. The second measure we have is called school choice, and it says for the parents who want their children out of public school, they can opt out and take a portion of what the public school system would have spent for a public school child, use that money instead to customize the education for their child among private school, homeschool, tutors, education therapists, computer, transportation, those sort of things, to meet the exact needs of their children. So we have two measures, and we're trying to use those measures to allow parents to have the full spectrum to choose from so that their child will be able to learn in the environment that actually meets their needs. We're trying to gather signatures now to get these two measures on the November 2024 ballot.
So I'm curious, you've got two ballots that people need to sign, and or two petitions, I should say. Do you ever get somebody saying, well, I'll sign that one, but not this one?
We do once in a while. Mostly everybody signs both, but sometimes for whatever reason, they'll sign one or the other. And we usually say, okay, that's fine. But if they ever ask us, you know, is that okay? Or if they ever lead in where we can ask them a question, we usually try to ask them, you know, why do you like this one and not that one? Or what is it about this one you don't want to sign? And then as we give them more information, they usually go, oh, okay, well, now I understand. I was thinking it was going to be this, but it's actually this, and it actually helps the kids. And therefore, so a lot of times they will then end up signing the second one also.
So give us an overview of how things are going so far.
Well, it's been great. We've had a lot of summer events. There have been fairs and festivals and farmers markets and all those. And we've had volunteers all over Oregon going to those events, most of them wearing our sort of obnoxious green t-shirts that say education freedom, but they stand out in a crowd, so that's why they're good. So we've had volunteers all across the state gathering signatures. We're about 10% in of what we need to gather. And now, since the summer events are starting to fall off, we are now looking to do outreach to private schools, colleges, preschools, and then also churches, synagogues, mosques, and basically some of those areas where it'll be inside. Don't know how long this wonderful sunshine will last, but we are starting to move toward outreach to those. So we would love volunteers to just basically say, look, I can do something right in my own community. I can go to the school that's down the street or the church that's down the street and approach them and spread the word and ask for signatures. Or I can put a table up in front of a post office or a Home Depot or the library, or I can just walk up and down my own street and talk to my neighbors and gather signatures. So there's a lot of ways that volunteers can help us and just do it right in their own community. They don't have to, as we did in the summer, drive to some of these events that were out of town.
And do your volunteers ever run into people, say public school teachers that maybe have been listening a little too hard to their unions that see this as a threat to public schools? Because it's really not. It's about giving children and parents the best options for their particular child.
Well, there is misinformation out there, and we do occasionally get maybe a retired public school teacher who has heard the misinformation and fears, oh, this is going to harm a public school. But when we're able actually to tell them, no, this actually, the way we drafted this, will result in more money being available to the public school students who remain in the schools, and that's just sort of common sense because of how much is spent on a child in public school, and when one of the children leaves and they only take a small portion of it, all the remaining monies stay in the public school, so that's then spread among the kids who stay there. So it makes financial sense to pass school choice. But also it allows teachers who sometimes get a real raw deal, just as the children need to have the environment that they can learn in, it also helps teachers who maybe are teaching in an environment that doesn't meet with what they want, but school choice then allows them to find the environment where they want to teach. And it also makes teachers more valuable to the administrators of public schools, because as there are more opportunities for these teachers who have all this experience and credentials, and if they're able to go to a different environment, all of a sudden their administrator values them more, which could result in a pay raise to them. So it helps financially to the schools, it helps the teachers, and the most important thing here is it helps the kids. And the whole point of what we're doing, and the whole point of why we even pay taxes, should be to make sure that all Oregon kids get a good education.
Right, and get the results that we would anticipate. You know, you guys have the slogan, let them learn. I hadn't really thought about it from the teacher's side of things in terms of getting into an environment where they feel better about teaching. Maybe you need a separate slogan that says, let them teach. All right, let's go take a break.
We are talking
with Donna Kreisberg. She is one of the leaders here in Oregon that real school choice on the ballot. We will continue that discussion next. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Donna Kreisberg. She's leading the effort in Oregon to get real school choice on the Oregon 2024 general election ballot. Their website is educationfreedomfororegon.com. The four is spelled out there, F-O-R, educationfreedomfororegon.com. We'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com on today's show page, which is 13-38. If you head there, you can donate, you can download petition sheets and share that link as well and help get the word out. And so, Donna, we got an email, a newsletter from School Choice, and you said, I shattered my leg in an accident about a month ago. My forward movement has been curtailed. I am blessed that my accident was not worse and that I am healing. So I know what happened, but tell our audience what happened.
Well, it's kind of embarrassing, but they say, you know, go out and do what your children do. Go outside and play with your kids. Go, you know, right. So I do that. So I'm riding a small dirt bike, which probably I shouldn't have done to begin with. But we were just finishing feeding horses, apples to horses, and we were coming back. We were in Montana on a dirt road sort of thing, a forest road. And I hit a patch of soft dirt, and my front wheel of the motorcycle started wobbling, and I instinctively put my right foot down, and next thing I know, my right ankle is at my right hip. Oof. And I'm looking down thinking, oh, this is not good. And then, you know, I sort of crashed and burned, and we were on a forest road that was hard to get to, so I was laying in the middle of the road for about an hour just in excruciating pain. But then luckily the helicopter landed, and long story short, they were able to fly me to a trauma center. But I'd never broken a bone before, and I'd never had any sort of impediment like that. So long story short, now it's been about 6 weeks. I've had some surgeries to reconstruct the leg. I'm, you know, basically having to lay on the couch in our family room because I can't walk, can't go upstairs. So it's frustrating, but I am blessed. I mean, it could have been much worse. But it does sort of bring up the what you can see things. I can see the kitchen counter, but I can't get there. I can see what I want to be doing at my computer or my desk, but I can't get there. So it's been frustrating, but it also makes me think about our students, because sure, there are students that are right now, based on where they live or their parents' income or some other situation, they're in a school environment that isn't serving them. They can't get their needs met. They know there's other options out there. They can see a different school or they can hear about it, but they can't get there. So while I was, you know, doing a little pity me sort of thing, I also realized, hey, this is kind of an eye-opening situation where I can now empathize a lot more with the kids that we're trying to help.
Sure.
Who basically, for not their own fault, are in an environment where they're not getting the full education that they need. So
yeah,
it was kind of a good kick in the butt and invigorated me.
Yeah, I thought that was really nice how you put that in the email newsletter. Excuse me. You said, sitting here with my leg in a brace, confined to my couch, is frustrated because I want to be up and about advancing our campaign to bring education options to Oregon families. And it makes me think how frustrating it must be for our students to be confined in a school setting instead of freely able to move to the school setting that works for them. And that really is a great analogy. And to take that step, take a step further, really, a bad education can be its own kind of injury that can hobble somebody's future, can't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think everybody knows how important education is to the future of that person, whether they start a business, whether they go on to be an employee or, you know, invent something. They needed to have had somebody believe in them and give them a good education and let them find something that just really triggers and lights them on fire and gets them all excited. And they don't have forever to do that. I mean, we have K-12 education, so it's not like we can blow five of those years for the kids and say, well, just make it up later. They need this right now. They need people believing in them, letting them be in an environment where their needs are met, their educational interests are addressed. And so it's very frustrating for me to know that there's some kids out there who need solutions that they don't have. So it helps get us all as volunteers excited to go out and get more signatures for this, to get it on the ballot, to allow parents to have these choices. If you don't want to change where you're at, that's fine too. But there are parents who desperately want to have their children in a different environment, and they just don't have the mechanism until we pass these two school choice measures.
Sure. And if you're in a public school that is doing well with students, you know, think of it this way, is that by having these ballot initiatives, it can allow parents to bring their kids to your school that is working. It just opens so many options for kids and for parents. As far as the initiative is concerned, what about educating for trade schools? We are extremely short of people being trained to enter the trades, and many students don't want a four-year degree, which neither delivers on jobs, nor is economically feasible. So some educators now believe that that kind of curriculum should actually start in the seventh grade that would focus on academics, the type of academics used in trade schools, such as more math, more critical thinking, and whatnot as part of the curriculum. Has charter schools figured that out, how to insert that type of curriculum into their schools?
Well, the wonderful thing about school choice is it will by itself bring entrepreneurs, excuse me, and new innovative ideas.
Yes.
So there could be a public school right now that doesn't offer any of those, but because of school choice and because parents are choosing which environment to be in, maybe a public school that's low on attendance will introduce trade school curriculum, and then parents can flock to that. But also in the private sector, with school choice and parents having the ability to choose an environment that works for their child, across the country, specific schools have been created to cater to specific interests, whether it's STEM or arts and music or hands-on type of programs. So while there may not be a lot of trade school curriculum right now in Oregon, school choice will kick it in the butt and make a lot of schools introduce that, because that would be something that parents want. So a school who's struggling to get people to come there can maybe wake up and go, gosh, if we deliver a curriculum and a program that parents want with open enrollment that's on the ballot, parents will be able to come to that school. So it gives the schools the ability to create their own focus and cater to the needs of parents. So it's going to be wonderful for public schools who want a new way to focus and get new students. And it'll also be good for private schools who get created with that sole focus in mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, competition in the free markets makes companies better, and competition can make schools better too, by knowing that they need to be more competitive, better, stronger, better education, and better meet the needs of their kids. Okay, everyone stay with us. We'll wrap things up with Donna Kreitzberg after this. There are two initiatives to get real school choice on the 2024 ballot. One covers the money aspect and allows some, not all, of the state funding to follow the child to their school of choice. And the other covers the choice side of things, giving parents the ability to choose whichever school they want. We're talking with Donna Kreitzberg, who is spearheading that effort. You can find out more by heading to educationfreedomfororegon.com. That's educationfreedom, F-O-R, Oregon.com. And so, Donna, Oregon is now taking another look at something called equity grading. In fact, some educators in Portland love this idea. And if people don't know what equity grading is, it's focused on how well students master specific academic schools while de-emphasizing things like turning in assignments on time, behaving well in class, and completing extra credit. In other words, it really ends up de-emphasizing the things that make people successful in real life and at real jobs, and instead emphasizes grading that never allows a failed or low grade, just basically a you can do better next time grade. And you know, effectively ribbons for everyone, whether you did well or not. This is probably, I think, the worst idea yet that our education department has had. Your thoughts on this?
Well, part of what we're doing is we're bringing the freedom for parents to choose. So while some parents may choose a school that I wouldn't put my children in for various reasons, I do want to make sure that everybody has the ability to choose whichever school fits their needs, and a school that might have a policy of not giving a zero grade for somebody who cheats or doesn't complete the work is not the environment that I would want my children in, because I don't think that fosters the incentive to do good work, the incentive to get it in on time, and the incentive to try, which then also brings the self-satisfaction of, wow, I did my best and
yes,
I turned it in, and those sort of things that I think are important for my children. But again, there could be parents where that's the environment that they want their child. And so our two measures will make sure that parents can choose any environment. We're giving everybody the choice, and not just saying, hey, you have to only go to this selection. So I think there are some policies coming out for our public schools in Oregon that are going to cause some concern for some parents, not all, but the not giving anybody a zero, even if they cheat or if they don't turn it in, and the fact that they are proposing to remove graduation requirements again, and that they are basically trying to say that we're focusing on things that are not the skill set building, that are not the core subjects that I think education originally was focused on. They seem to be, you know, kind of going afield of those. But again, parents are able to choose if that's the environment and those are the kind of curriculum and goals that they want for their children, then our two measures will allow them to do that and choose any school that meets that needs. So it's sort of a, parents need to be aware that there are changes happening in public schools. And if they agree and you want your child in that environment, we will allow you through the open enrollment to choose any public school, even one that's closer to your house. And so that will help those parents, but it'll also help the parents that say, you know, I don't agree with those policies. I want to move my child to a different public school or a charter school, or pull them out of the system altogether and have them in a private school.
Yeah. Well, this type of grading, people or kids, I should say, they can still get 50% even if they don't hand in the assignment at all. I mean, 50% for nothing. I mean, if you can't hit bottom, you really have no reason to try to climb out. You don't learn to succeed. You learn to exist. And I guess I shouldn't be surprised that government came up with this scheme, because it makes it look like you're doing better, your children are doing better, without actually doing better. Again, it really removes incentive from this whole process. One teacher in Springfield was quoted as saying he's been teaching for 25 years, and before the pandemic, about 6 to 8% of his students could not pass his class. Under equitable grading, that rate doubled. And I think this is the real killer here. He says equity grading also prevents him from rewarding those who try extra hard and those who work through tremendous difficulties. If you want to make kids fail in life, you divorce rewards from accomplishment. And it's the same type of problem that happens when people commit crimes but suffer no punishment. Society, I think, is in for a world of hurt on this.
Well, and also what's interesting is that when the report card comes out, it doesn't give a clear picture of where little Johnny is.
No.
So a parent that can look at that report card won't have a clear indication that, wow, my child might be struggling in reading, or
right,
he's doing super well in math. So, you know, I think that the report card is also part of the problem here if it's not gauging the skills that the parent needs to know about. So that I think that the combination of equity grading and a report card that isn't providing the necessary information to a parent will disguise and make the parent think everything is fine, and then their child completes high school, gets out, maybe can't make change, can't read, can't get a good job, doesn't qualify for the college that they thought or the trade school that they needed to go to. So it's causing a problem that's going to have, you know, significant also repercussions when the child completes high school.
Right.
So it's something that I think parents need to be aware of and address. And I don't think that the public schools are doing us a service by also not showing proficiencies anymore. They might be testing the children, but they're not going to publish those proficiency scores anymore. So again, they're sort of disguising from the parent that there might be an underlying problem. And if the parent isn't alerted to it, parents are busy. They won't know it until possibly it's too late.
Yeah. Well, and the effort here, of course, is they don't want kids to feel bad when they fail. Well, they're going to feel terrible once they get out of school, and then they know what real failure is like. Donna, thank you so much for what you're doing, and thank you so much for your time today for being here.
Well, thank you, Mark. I appreciate it. And I would love for all of your listeners to go to our website, educationfreedomfororegon.com, and help us bring these important measures to the ballot by signing our petitions, becoming a volunteer, donating. We could use all the help from all the folks that listen to your show.
Absolutely. Scott Shepard is joining us now. He's the director of Free Enterprise Project at the National Center for Public Policy Research, where he is also a fellow. The Free Enterprise Project is the original and premier opponent of the woke takeover of American corporate life. Scott, it is great to talk to you again.
It's great to talk to you anytime, Mark.
Yeah, so we had wanted to talk about a couple topics that Free Enterprise Project is focused on: the end of affirmative action there in higher ed and its effect in corporate America, and also Bob Iger's continuing destruction of a once proud American company, Disney. And you have a recent article up there: affirmative action is racist and illegal in corporate America, just as it was in higher education. And here's the thing. The court ruled that colleges and universities will have to use only methods that are race neutral for admissions and will no longer be able to discriminate against or in favor of applicants based on their race. And that's higher ed, of course. And now we're going to be looking at the corporate world. But, you know, my first encounter with affirmative action was in ninth grade social studies when we talked about it. And I remember thinking very distinctly at the time, wait a minute, favoritism toward one race over another is every bit as racist as discrimination against one race over another. If I could figure that out in ninth grade, why did it take the Supreme Court so long to figure things out?
Well, you know, there are certain things that every ninth grader or second grader can easily understand about justice and fairness and truth and applying the same standards both ways, but they get lost the higher you go up the education chain, so that by the time somebody has a PhD or a law degree, they just can't quite figure out how math works, because it's and I know math is racist these days, but yes. Maybe this is why, because it's just a mathematical, it's a very simple mathematical formula. If you discriminate in favor of some, you must by definition be discriminating against others.
Exactly right.
That would be the first day of elementary symbolic logic, sophomore year of college. But then, of course, once you get into grad school, you've lost that too.
Yeah. So with the striking down of affirmative action in higher ed, what impact do you think this is going to have on corporations?
Oh, well, I mean, in a sense, it's redundant, the case, because there has been, since the Bakke case in, I think, 76, 77, there's been this carve out in education for discrimination in order to make more diversity in the student body. That shut down this summer. That was shut down by UNC Harvard. That's never been true in business. Mm. And so, in a sense, this case doesn't change anything in business, but it helps to highlight the fact that everything these businesses have been doing that favors on the basis of race, sex, or orientation. So in other words, everything related to this new equity push that started in the riot summer of 2020, all of it is illegal. Mm-hmm. And all of it's obviously illegal. It's more obviously illegal after the UNC Harvard case. It's illegal in ways that we expect that corporate executives should be held liable for condoning, because they should know better. They should be getting advice not just from left-wing partisans like Eric Holder at Covington and Burling, but they should be getting advice from neutrals, and neutrals would say, yep, you're taking race into account. That's super illegal unless you can point out how you were explicitly racist against that group, your company, in the past. And these companies, Levi's and Starbucks, none of them can point to ways in which they were keeping blacks from being baristas in some systemic way. So they're all in trouble, and I look forward to a lot of them ending up having to pay out of their own pockets because of their righteous stupidity and evil.
So are you thinking then that this is going to roll over into corporate America in the sense that it could end those kind of race-based initiatives, like, you know, we're talking DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, which, like affirmative action, seeks to exclude segments of the population as much as it seeks to include others? I mean, are you thinking that's going to be on the chopping block now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think that part of the reason that corporations have moved so far left is because executives were dumb for many years, and then they got trapped. Now, some of them are true believers, but with others, they didn't pay attention, and then set up a diversity and inclusion whole department. The only point of that department is to push the corporations left on social stuff. Then they set up sustainability departments. The only purpose of that department is to push them left on carbon and net zero stuff, even a huge cost to the company. So now at law, the law is going to require unraveling of one of these sets of left-wing single ratchet departments. And I suspect reality is rapidly going to require the demolition of the other one.
Hmm. Is there going to be a difference on this sort of stuff between publicly traded companies versus privately held ones, or are there just going to be blanket rules for one and all?
Well, it's easier for groups like us, activist groups, to get at the publicly traded companies, but the law applies, and it applies the same way to privately held companies or to publicly traded companies. So I would expect that if there are privately held companies, like the Soros constellation of evildoers who still want to discriminate in the name of equity and diversity, well, you know, I would happily help anybody who wanted to sue them into perdition. So,
Now, yeah. What about the flip side of things? You've got DEI, that's diversity, equity, and inclusion, but you've also got ESG out there, which is environmental, social, and governance. That's not so much race-based, but it definitely favors one end and only one end of the political spectrum, the far left. Do you see?
Oh, that's right. The S part of ESG is mostly about race, sex, and orientation discrimination in favor of the favored, the modernly, that's not a word, but the modernly favored groups. The E is mostly about ruining our nation's reliance on reliable and affordable energy to push for reliance on unaffordable and unreliable energy. But obviously, that's a terrible business model. As Germany's found out, Sri Lanka's found out, Southern Africa's found out.
Yep.
Everywhere it's tried, it fails. And so as the evidence rises, activists like us and state actors and other large investors and the whole panoply of people who don't want the American economy and their investments to collapse are going to be getting into gear. Now, if private companies want to go net zero and waste their owners' fortunes, that's up to them. And, you know, a couple examples of that. George Will in 92 said Albania should stay communist, so we have a permanent example of how bad that was. If a couple of these private companies want to say, we'll go net zero, then we can point and laugh as those billionaires' fortunes disappear. And I think that's exactly what they deserve.
Well, the great thing about going net zero and the green energy and all that is when the lights go out and it's completely dark, we're all the same race. So there you go. All right.
That's right. They're going to cancel out one of their evils with the other of their evils because they won't be able to discriminate in the dark. I love it.
That's right. Okay, let's take a break. Come back when we talk about woke Disney. We're doing that with Scott Shepard of the Free Enterprise Project. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Scott Shepard. He has taught at law schools, including Wake Forest and right here in Oregon at Willamette University's Law School. He is the director for National Center for Public Policy Research's Free Enterprise Project, which defends true capitalism and free markets and fights against the woke takeover of American corporations. And speaking of woke takeovers, there is probably no better company that exemplifies a stubborn determination to go woke than Disney. Yes, there's Bud Light out there, but Bud Light never had the reputation that Disney once had. They have now squandered that and become the opposite of what they used to be, a proudly pro-American, pro-family company that we all grew up with. And Scott, before we get into the particulars of Disney's overall slide into wokeism, let's get a little bit of a broader view of corporations in America today. If a company's leadership is determined to go woke, is there really much that shareholders can do to stop it?
Well, what we're seeing is that for a long time there wasn't. There was no way for us or others to get a good handle on it, but that reality in the markets are now putting a big check against going woke. I mean, two of the you point out that Disney is a Bob Iger's stamp on this company will have been making it go hard left and costing it its world bestriding position. Mm-hmm. Likewise, Target has a lunatic left wing board of directors. It always has, and it's paying the price now because it's been so over the top about it. And so we're seeing ways that consumers can really respond if they move in the same direction at the same time. And we're starting to get involved. We may end up suing Target for burning down shareholder value that way. We've seen other activist investors step in last winter at Disney to say, how about you run this place a little less stupidly? Now, Iger hasn't taken that opportunity. And so we might see another challenge this winter, but I think that for a long time the public wasn't paying enough attention, and the states weren't paying enough attention, and investors weren't paying enough attention. But the attention really has focused now, and so I think there's a whole set of ways that corporations are going to be challenged by state actors, by plaintiffs in court, by shareholders, all the way up and down the line. So I think there really is a way to respond now.
So when you're talking shareholder lawsuits, where a board's action has destroyed share values and ruined investors, what do you need to be able to prove that, other than the fact that, I mean, how do you prove that the board was responsible for that?
Oh, well, they have to keep records of what they're doing. And there are some threshold of issue that has to rise to board level. So at this point, a decision to embrace the hard left trans agenda would have to be taken at board level. The decision to go to keep going with the racist, sexist, and orientation discriminatory programs would have to be taken at the board level. There's a secondary rule. Part of fiduciary duty is the duty to pay attention. Right? It's the duty to competently direct the company. So at some point, a failure of the board to have taken cognizance of these big issues and to have signed off is itself a violation of fiduciary duty. It's incompetence.
So let's look at the opposite scenario where there's a pro-America company that wants to be or wants to remain pro-America, but a bunch of far-left investors target it and want to break and want to stop that. So if the BlackRocks and George Soros's of the world swoop in and snap up shares, can they push that company into wokeism?
No, they really can't. And that's because a central rule of American capitalism, American corporate law, is that directors have to act not on behalf of the personal ideologies of its biggest investors, but on behalf of an average, ordinary, reasonable investor who wants nothing but maximization of returns. So if we've heard from a lot of companies, including in court filings, that BlackRock has forced them to undertake illegally discriminatory policies, to set up illegally discriminatory programs. But that's not a defense by the directors and executives, because they're not allowed to do the bidding of any specific, even large shareholders, unless the thing that those large shareholders want are both legal and are going to benefit the company. And so I think that a lot of CEOs, a lot of C-suites have thought that just going along with what BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard demand was not only okay, but necessary. But I think they're going to find out in the coming years that that's no defense at all.
Yeah, well, I seem to recall that there's been several studies out that show that the more a company embraces DEI and ESG, the worse off their performance is. And so I would think they'd be paying attention to that sort of thing. Let's shift to Disney now. Iger left Disney as CEO in 2020 and was considered among really the best C-suite executives in the business. Disney was on the cutting edge of programming and forays into streaming, and its stock price just soared. His handpicked successor was Bob Chapek, but then Disney soon faltered. Programming, which was moving left anyway, went off the deep end with a lesbian kissing scene in the allegedly kid-friendly Buzz Lightyear movie. They've had other box office flops. Revenue has faltered, and Disney began to panic. So Chapek was kicked to the curb, and Iger came back, and everything's fixed now, right?
Well, no. First of all, Iger engineered his return. He never left the CEO's office. Bob Chapek was technically the CEO, but Iger refused to, in practice, step down. He kept his hands on everything, and he's personally responsible for destroying Disney. He's the one who was the uber political guy who wanted it to go left woke, who wanted Disney to teach the world to have his politics, politics that you know, as the left moved further and further into lunacy, he moved further and further with them, and now most people don't trust their kids with Disney anymore, which would have been shocking in our kids' childhoods, our childhoods, our parents' childhoods, and our grandparents' childhoods.
Yeah.
That's some impressive effort.
Yeah, really.
And people are staying away. It's toxic enough that they're staying away from the parks. Also, the parks are now badly run. Disney Plus is largely a failure because it just has woke crap on it, and nobody wants to watch that, and they can't trust their kids with that. So they had to make a deal with Spectrum to give a cut rate price to Disney for Disney Plus, which means that Chapek was trying to get as many subscribers as possible with a low rate. He got kicked out. Iger came in. He raised the cost, which caused a huge cut in the number of American subscribers, which is, American, the West is where the money is.
Right.
But huge fall in American subscribers. But now Disney has had to effectively cut the price back down with this Spectrum deal. Everybody else is going to demand the same deal. So Disney Plus is going to be a permanent money loser. And then there are the movies.
Yeah,
they've managed the impossible.
Yeah, they have just totally tanked this last summer for sure. We are up against a break. Everyone stay with us. We'll continue the discussion with Scott Shepherd about the crash of Disney. Scott Shepherd is the director of the Free Enterprise Project, a project with the National Center for Public Policy Research. You can find out more about Free Enterprise Project and National Center's other great work at nationalcenter.org, nationalcenter.org. Free Enterprise Project's mission is to push back on woke corporate America and defend true capitalism and free markets. They have a number of great articles that informed our discussion today, and we'll link all of those up on today's show page on iSpyRadio.com, which is, and today's show is 13-38. And so, Scott, looking at the mess that Iger did, do you suspect that he trashed Disney so he could come back and then claim that he fixed it? You know, the old Marxism of create the problem and then offer the solution.
Well, I mean, he very definitely never left the CEO's office. He was always around the building. And then he pushed Chapek into the position that destroyed Chapek, because Chapek was trying to stay out of that argument with DeSantis about the Florida bill that the left called the Don't Say Gay bill, even though it never says gay in the bill. You know, Chapek wanted to stay out of it. Iger went on CNBC Squawk Box or some dumb thing like that and said that Chapek was letting Disney down by not getting into the fight. He forced Chapek to get into the fight. And then when the fight went extremely badly for Disney, Isaac Iger used that fact to get rid of Chapek. They fired him, and Iger came back in on a Sunday night when Chapek was at an Elton John concert with half of the Disney C-suite, which is, you know, the kind of class you expect from Bob Iger.
Yeah.
But then Iger came back and he continued and ramped up the fight with DeSantis. He said, well, you know, if we can't keep Reedy Creek, we're going to stop investing in Florida. Just this past week, they announced huge new investments in Florida because the parks are the only thing that's making any money at all for Disney. And so they have to spend the money there, and they can't possibly afford to lose the East Coast complex that's all sunk costs in Florida. So that was BS. It's just up and down the line. Everything Iger does turns out to be a catastrophe, including burning down Lucasfilms, burning down Indiana Jones by having its last movie hate Indiana Jones, which was fairly astonishing, burning down Star Wars, burning down Pixar. I don't know as much about Marvel, but that seems to have run its course. And I tell you, I'm a 50-year-old man. I can't imagine how many more superhero movies anybody wants to see anymore.
Yeah, well, I really lost my interest with Marvel when it started to go woke. They had a couple of films that were pretty woke, and what they did to the Thor character, they totally demasculized him, and so I thought, you know, I think I'm done with Marvel. If they're part of Disney, they're just going to continue marching left. But you know, I don't get why CEOs like Iger and some of these other ones that are pushing this woke stuff, I just don't think they get the math. You know, we were talking about that earlier. Every poll in the last 5 decades has shown that conservatives make up about 40 to 45% of the population, which is twice the amount of progressives, which routinely poll at about 20 to 22%. There are far more people who are pro-America and pro-family than there are who are anti-America and anti-family, and yet they pander to these smaller audiences and then are shocked that they lose audience.
Yep.
I don't get it.
Well, you know, part of it is that they live in their left-wing bubbles and they have no idea how the rest of us think. But part of it, too, is you take Bob Iger. Obviously, everybody knows that Uncle Walt built Walt Disney. It's right in the name. Everybody knows that Brian Moynihan, who's the current CEO of Bank of America, had nothing to do with building Bank of America. He's just a boring, fat bureaucrat.
Yeah.
Who's accomplished basically nothing, and yet he's a billionaire, and they feel guilty about having all this money for themselves and not having really done much to earn it. But they want to keep their billions. So what they do is embrace this hard left stuff, convincing themselves that it's going to make the world a better place. Moynihan at Bank of America keeps talking talking about, I know what the world demands of us. He doesn't know what the world demands. He knows what his country club demands. And what his country club demands is that the rest of us become poorer because we have to rely on expensive and unreliable energy, that we have to take public transportation while he takes a limousine from his mansion to his private jet to fly to Davos to make more, to come up with more ways with his billionaire buddies to make the rest of us poorer. And he thinks that's conscientious. He and Larry Fink at BlackRock, they think that's conscientious capitalism, but it's corrupt and disgusting, and all to hide the fact that they know in their hearts that they haven't accomplished very much.
Earlier in the year, Iger was talking about, you know, is sort of hinting that they may have to start selling off some properties like ESPN and, you know, maybe ABC and some of these other ones. Do you get the sense they are going to sell off some of these properties?
Well, now that they destroyed ESPN, I think they can probably get 27, 28 cents for it. I saw a story. I was traveling last week, saw a story, sent it to my brother because I knew it would make his head explode. ESPN has hired that Kaepernick fella. No. Ibram Kendi, one of the explicators of the evil that is discriminatory equity, right? Hired him to have a show talking about racism in sports. I mean, the six people who aren't hard left who still watch ESPN, that's it for them. And so ESPN, I mean, partly because of the cable cutting, but also partly because of this woke, this run at wokeness, ESPN isn't worth much anymore. So they can sell ABC. All the six people are still watching Shonda Rhimes, right? They can sell ESPN, but they're not going to get much for it. And they've got to come up. Disney's got to come up this in the next month or so with $28 billion to buy the remaining third of Hulu, to buy it from Comcast. They pretty much admitted on their third quarter call, guidance call, they don't have the money. They said, well, we've still got credit facilities and stuff, which is, in other words, at 7%, at a 7% prime rate, we might be able to borrow enough, but it could be fire sale time for Bob Iger's trash Disney.
Well, the reason I had asked that earlier about Marxism and whether or not he had created this problem that he could then come back in and fix, it's rumored that Iger is or at least was considering a run for the presidency. Do you see that happening?
Oh, man, I would so pay to see that. I might donate to him just to watch the meltdown. If we thought it was funny watching Mike Bloomberg make an ass out of himself in the one debate that he qualified before he set himself on fire, oh, Bob Iger would be fun.
Well, we can wish for that sort of thing. All right. Well, anyway, Scott Shepard, I want to thank you so much for your time today. This has been great.
Any time at all, Mark. And please tell Carla, give Carla my best. I always love to talk to you.
So here's something. Investopedia shows that Disney reports its diversity, equity, and inclusiveness for its employees, but not for its board of directors, not for its C-suite officers, and not for its general managers. Woke for thee, but not for me. If you'd like to see that chart, see iSpyRadio.com. Today's show is 13-38. Whether it's a chance at a great investment or a chance to do something for good when you can, don't squander the opportunities that come your way. We have a chance to get real school choice here in Oregon, and this is an investment that will pay dividends well into the future. Don't miss this and then kick yourself later on, if only I had done more to make that happen. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.